What an appropriate song.
What a, I love that song. I love the message. I love just the way that it sounds when we sing it and sing it well. You know, as I was preparing for the sermon today and trying to think, you know, one of the things that I've really grown to appreciate and to love is something that I haven't done a whole lot of until here. When I was in St. Louis, I didn't preach a lot of sermon series or whatever. I don't even know what the word is. But I really have grown to like that because I like things when they kind of wrap together and they sort of, you know, flow. I think, you know, for me, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but for me, it always seems like Sunday is upon us. I feel like I'm just always here and I'm always sitting right over there kind of behind Mark and always nervous about it's almost my turn. And so really, I don't see a whole lot of time between last Sunday and today. And so it's hard for me just to sort of preach. Now it is for me just to start preaching about different things, you know, here, that, and the other, because they all just kind of run together as one long sermon. And really, I don't need any comment about one long sermon from anybody at this point, so I'm just going to throw that on out there. But it really does, and so I like the way that sermon series just sort of flow together. And so after finishing the call, the call narrative sermon series, and before we go into a series on commitment and giving and just the ministry of Highland Hills as a whole, the last 2 weeks have been difficult, really, to think about as far as how they wrap all together. And so this morning, I really want to preach about something that kind of stands on its own. And I told Dick that the topic was just Jesus, Jesus, and more Jesus. And I really, as we think about, and I hope that we've really been considering the idea and the thought and the reality that God is calling us and he's desiring us to be in his work and in his kingdom work. And the best example that we have of kingdom work and fulfilling the calling that he places is that of the life of our Savior Jesus Christ. 100% human and yet 100% God. At the same time, the mystery of God incarnate is the best example that I can come up with of fulfilling the calling that he has placed on us. And as I've been teaching on Wednesday nights about miracles and the reality of the miracles as they take place then and as they take place now and as they relate to us, recently we talked about the miracle we talked about, you know, the miracles that took place right before Jesus clears the temple. And in John, the very beginning of John, he illustrates this happening that takes place really at the end of the ministry of Christ, when Jesus goes into the temple and he drives out the money changers and the lenders, and he drives out all of those who are using the temple of that day as a thoroughfare and a marketplace and really he gets so angry with them, and he tells them that my Father's house will be a house of prayer. And as I've studied that and prayed about it and just really meditated on that happening, you know, it's really a concerning story in the life of Christ, Jesus clearing the temple. It's disturbing imagery for us when we think about the meek Lamb of God fashioning a whip and really yelling and driving people out and turning things over and destroying property. It's a disturbing image for us to consider. And I've heard many sermons about godly anger, and I've talked about that, and I've considered that it's a display of appropriate anger. But the more that I think about it, I realize that is a story. It's a episode of the life of Christ illustrating the truth. It's all about the truth. And when we think about Jesus, his example of following God's calling, when we think about the fact that the example of Jesus being our Messiah and fulfilling the God-given calling on his life, and as we follow his example to do the same, Our calling, our life, and our relationship with God is all about truth. It's all about not saying one thing and doing another. Not calling something that isn't as though it is. You see, when Jesus goes and he drives out the money changers and the lenders, he drives out those who are using the temple as a thoroughfare, he's saying, this is not what the temple is supposed to be. This isn't what worship looks like. This isn't what it acts like. This isn't what it produces. This is not what you claim it to be. So get out of here. It's all about the truth. And as we consider verses like Philippians 4 and chapter 8, where he says, whatever is good, whatever is righteous, whatever is true, whatever is noble, think on these things. Whenever we think about thinking on the truth, whenever we think about verses like John chapter 8, 31 and following to 32, where he says, if you are really my disciples, if you hold to my teaching, if you do what it is that I call you to do and you really are my disciples, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. When we consider verses like that, my worry and my concern, my fear is that the truth is bleeding from 1,000 wounds. Where we have so taken the truth and caused it to be what we want it to be. When we dress up the temple in all kinds of tables and booths, and when we take it and make it a place of money changing and of lending and a thoroughfare for us to come and to go at our own convenience, the truth is really not the truth, but it is what we want it to be. And in pursuit of the truth, in pursuit of the truth, in pursuit of Christ, it isn't that we would resolve to stop petty lying to one another. It's not a decision to stop deceiving others. But the gospel points out that the pursuit of truth is a decision to stop deceiving ourselves. Stop embracing the lie that is so little spirituality and so little Christ-likeness in the lives of so many of His people. But to be real, to be honest, to live the truth. You see, tough love like that truly sets us free. I want to share a story, and bear with me because there's one thing that I dislike, and that's being read to, but there's no other way for me to do this justice. But there is, in his book, The Ragamuffin Gospel, I had this marked. Oh, here it is. Brennan Manning shares a story about an alcoholic who goes to a treatment facility. And he shares it also in this book, The Importance of Being Foolish, Living the Life of Christ. And he says, the painful question that we must face in the church today is whether the love of God can be purchased so cheaply. Many years ago, I witnessed the power of self-deception dramatically reenacted in the alcoholic rehabilitation center of a small American town. The scene is set in a large split-level living room set on the brow of a hill overlooking an artificial lake. 25 men, all chemically dependent on alcohol or drugs, have gathered. Steve O'Connor, a recovering alcoholic, the head honcho, a trained counselor, a skilled therapist, and senior member of the staff. He summons Max, a small, diminutive man, to sit alone at the center of the U-shaped group. Max is a nominal Christian, married with 5 children, owner and president of his own company, wealthy and affable, gifted with remarkable poise. O'Connor begins the interrogation. How long have you been drinking like a pig, Max? Max winces. Well, that's not quite fair. Well, we'll see. Let's get into your drinking history, shall we? How much per day? Well, I have 2 Marys with the men before lunch and 2 Martins when the office closes at 5. Then, what in God's name are Marys and Martins? O'Connor interrupts. You know, Bloody Marys, vodka, tomato juice, a dash of Worcestershire, and martinis, extra dry, straight up, ice cold, with an olive and a lemon twist. Thank you, Mary Martin. Go on. The wife likes to drink before dinner. Got her hooked on Martins years back. Max smiles. You understand that, right, guys? No one responds. We have two of them before, and we have two then and two before bed. 8 drinks a day, Max, O'Connor inquires. That's right, not a drop more, not a drop less. Sound familiar? What's the next line he's going to say? You're a liar. You're a liar. Max is not ruffled. I'll pretend I didn't hear that. Been in business 28 years. People know my word is my bond. Built my reputation on veracity, not mendacity. Ever hide a bottle in your house? Asked Benjamin, a Native American from New Mexico. Don't be ridiculous. I've got a bar in my living room the size of a horse. Nothing personal, O'Connor. Mary Martin is smiling again. Do you keep any booze in the garage, Mary? Naturally, I've got to replenish the stock. I do a lot of entertaining at my home and at my business. You understand that, right, guys? Again, no response. How many bottles in the garage? I don't really know offhand. I'd say 2 cases of vodka, 4 cases of gin, a bevy of liqueurs. The interrogation continues another 20 minutes. Max dodges, ducks, evades, hedges, fudges, minimalizes, rationalizes, and justifies his drinking pattern. Finally, hemmed in by relentless cross-examination, he reluctantly admits that he keeps a bottle in the nightstand, one in a suitcase for travel purposes, another in his bathroom cabinet for medicinal purposes, and 3 more at the office for entertaining clients. He squirms occasionally, but never loses his veneer or confidence or serene sense of self-possession. You're a liar, another voice booms. No need to get vindictive, Charlie, Max shoots back. Remember the biblical image of John's gospel with the speck in your brother's eye and the 2x4 in your own? And the other one, Matthew this time, about the pot and the kettle. O'Connor picks up the phone and dials a number in a distant city. It's Max's hometown. O'Connor puts the call on speakerphone and a man answers. Hank Shea? Asks O'Connor. Yeah, who's this? My name is Stephen O'Connor. I'm a counselor at a rehabilitation center in the Midwest, and I need some help. You remember a customer named Max? Yep, comes the reply. Good. With his family's permission, I'm researching his drinking history. You tend bar at that establishment every afternoon, so I was wondering if you could tell me roughly how much Max drinks on a daily basis. I know Max, but are you sure you've got his okay for this? I've got a signed affidavit, so shoot. Well, he's a heck of a guy. I really like him. He drops $100 in here every afternoon, has 8 martinis, buys a few drinks, and always leaves me a big tip. A great man. Max leaps to his feet and lets loose with a stream of profanity. He attacks O'Connor's ancestry, assails at Charlie's legitimacy, and impugns the whole unit's integrity. He bellows and bleeps and blasphemes. He claws at the sofa and spits on the rug. Then he regains his composure. He reseats himself, readjusts his mask, realigns his defenses, and remarks matter-of-factly that even Jesus lost his cool in the temple when he saw how the Sadducees hawking pigeons and pastries. After an extemporaneous homily to the group of justifiable anger and the like, he sits back and presumes that the inquiry is over. Have you ever been unkind to one of your kids? Glad you brought that up, Fred. I've got a fantastic rapport with my 4 boys. Last Thanksgiving, I took them on a fishing expedition to the Rockies. 4 days of roughing it in the wilderness. A heck of a time. 2 graduated from Harvard, you know, and Max Jr. is at his 3rd year at, he was interrupted. I didn't ask you that. At least once in his life, every father is unkind to one of his kids. I'm 62, and I vouch for it. Now give me one specific example. A long pause ensues. Finally, Max responds, well, I was a little unkind to my 9-year-old daughter last Christmas Eve. Well, what happened? I don't remember. Just get this heavy feeling whenever I think about it. Where did it happen? What were the circumstances? Wait 1 minute, Max says, his anger rising again. I told you, I don't remember. I just have this bad feeling. Unobtrusively, O'Connor dials Max's hometown once more and speaks with Max's wife. So, Connor calling, ma'am. Your husband just told me that he was unkind to your daughter last Christmas Eve. Can you give me the details, please? As a soft voice fills the room. Yeah, I can tell you. Our daughter, Debbie, wanted a certain pair of shoes for Christmas. On the afternoon of the 24th, my husband drove her downtown, gave her $40, and told her to buy whatever she wanted. That's what she did. When she got back into the truck, she kissed Max and told him he was the best daddy in the whole world. he was probably preening himself like a peacock, and decided to celebrate on the way home. He stopped at a tavern near here and told Debbie that he'd be right out. It was a cold, clear day, about 18 degrees. So Max left the motor running and locked both doors so that no one could get in. It was a little after 3 in the afternoon. And then silence.
Yes?
The sound of heavy breathing. Her voice grows faint. She's fighting back tears. My husband came out of the bar after midnight. He was drunk. The motor had stopped and the windows were frozen shut. Debbie was badly frostbitten on both ears and on her fingers. When we got to the hospital, the doctors had to operate. They amputated a thumb and a forefinger in her right hand, and she'll be deaf the rest of her life. Max looks as though he's having a seizure. He's on his feet, making short, jerky, uncoordinated movements. His glasses fly from his face as he collapses on all fours and begins sobbing hysterically. O'Connor stands up and says quietly, "Let's go." As the men get up to leave, they look at Max. None of them will forget what they see. Mary Martin, wealthy, a sophisticated man of the world, father of 5, chronic alcoholic, is still on all fours. His sobs have soared to shrieks. O'Connor approaches him, pushes his foot against Max's ribcage so that he rolls over on his back. "Look, pig, there's the door, and there's the window. Take whichever you can get out of the fastest. I'm not running a hotel for lives." Now that sounds pretty brutal, doesn't it? That sounds pretty ridiculous to treat someone that way. I mean, aren't we supposed to love them, to understand them? But you see, it's that response right there, getting to the rock bottom bedrock of who this man was, that started his recovery. I could read you 5 more pages. I won't do that, but the moral of the story, the ending of the story, is that Max begs for an opportunity to come back to the facility. And they allow him to, and through love like that, through finding out exactly who he truly is, does he start his recovery. And that portion of the book ends with him praying for the very first time in his life with a clean conscience before God and the ability to start from that moment being truly broken. He's broken, absolutely. He's wounded for the rest of his life. He's damaged goods, to say the least, but he is free because of the truth. So many times we stand before God, a prisoner of the deception, not of deceiving others, but deception of deceiving ourselves. You see, truth consists of detaching ourselves from the appearances in order to acknowledge the reality of sin, the reality of alcoholism, or lust, or greed, or pride, or anger, or jealousy, the reality of self-righteousness, or the reality of apathy, the reality of just not caring. You see, in John's gospel, the liar stubbornly blinds himself and embraces the darkness. Whether it's John chapter 8, in verse 44, where he describes, Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I came from God and now I'm here. I have not come on my own, but he sent me. Why is my language not clear to you? Because you are unable to hear what I say. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth. There's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies." Or in John's epistle, in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 8, where it says that the liar prompts us to give importance to that that has no importance. He clothes us with falseness, with the glitter of this world. And he turns us away from what is real. See, the conflict between the father of lies and the truth that is Jesus Christ dominates the Gospels. You see, the implications for the serious, Christ-centered Christian who is seeking to have the mind of Christ in Philippians that we read in Philippians 2 in verse 5. We have to realize that for most of us, what is most real is the material, physical world. What is most unreal is the world of God. How does this manifest itself in our life? What's most real to us is the material world. What's most unreal is the world of God. Because we're pro-life when it comes to an unborn fetus. But are we pro-life when it comes to the Muslim, to the murderer, or to the guilty? What's most unreal is the world of God. Is our highest moral imperative to keep up a good front. You see, the loss of truth starts with the loss of wonder. When we lose our wonder for who and what and how God is the beginning of the loss of truth. My question is, remember how things used to be bigger. Whether it was the wide-eyed wonder of a child walking into the living room on Christmas morning to discover the passage of Santa in the night. Whether it was waking up on Easter morning to have a basket full of goodies that the presence and the arrival of which that was unexplainable to the child. Or the coin that just shows up under the pillow after a traumatic bloody bout with some dental floss and a doorknob. Or maybe it was just something as benign as the counter at the bank. I remember going into the bank with my mom, and that counter just seemed to be 10 stories tall. And there was something going on the other side, and I could hear all kinds of clicking and whirs and buzzing and all, and a little dum-dum lollipop always reached itself over the counter, and it was just amazing what was going on. They made money back there. Right, Howard? And now, there's no awe, there's no wonder. What changed? What changed about the awe and the wonder? We did. We got bigger. The loss of truth starts with the loss of wonder. And Jesus says in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 3, unless you change and become like little children. And I've heard and I've preached 1,000 sermons on we have to be dependent and we have to be all kinds of this or that about children, and they are forgiving and they are this and they are. You know what children are? They're littler than everything in their world. Unless we change and become like little children. When you're a child, everything's bigger than you are. Especially God. The truth of the matter is that God is not for us to control. He's not for us to understand. God isn't for us to manage or to even approach. God is to be awed. And that is where truth lives, where truth breathes, where truth is real. When did we become incapable of awe? But it's easy to talk about awe of creation. Oh, I'm in awe of God, Shane. I look at the stars. I'm in awe of God. I look at the Grand Canyon. I look at the mountains. I look at the human body. I'm in awe of God and His creation. Let's look at the awe that we have. You see, we need to go no further than Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. The Sermon on the Mount gives away our lack of awe. We sanitize the most important illustration of the truth. When if someone strikes you on your right cheek, turn to him also your left. If someone sues you for your cloak, offer your tunic as well. Give to the one in need and don't ask for it back. If your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. The loss of the truth begins with the loss of wonder. You see, we're too satisfied with our decent little lives, and we're often too pleased with our good habits that we call our virtues and our little efforts that we call progress. We're proud of our activities. They make us feel as though we're giving of ourselves. Impressed with our influence, we think it transforms lives. And we're proud of what we give, though it hides what we withhold. What happens when the loss of wonder makes the gospel ethic less and less practical? I mean, if someone is sued, if I'm sued, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to lawyer up. If someone strikes me, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make it so difficult for them to strike me again. If someone asks for something that I have, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find out a way to withhold that in its entirety. The wonder is regained only when we grasp the fundamental meaning within the radical demands that are given to us through the ministry of Christ in the gospel, while at the same time understanding that we can never completely fulfill any of those. Wonder is regained in forgiveness. And God is bigger than anything we could ever hope or imagine. You know what passage I love about this is, we just got through talking about it, the miracle of the miraculous catch at the end of John 21. When Jesus shows up and Peter swims to him and he's there on the beach of the Sea of Galilee, Peter has denied Christ. He has once again blown it. Jesus' silence on the matter is exquisite. Never once did Jesus ever bring up what you did, Peter. And Peter's eyes are open. His awe and his wonder and his desire, his ability to fulfill the calling on his life was manifest the day he understood the total redemption and forgiveness of God. I love Matthew 28 and 10. There on that Easter morning at the tomb, he tells Mary Magdalene, he says, you know what? Go tell my brothers. I read that and it affects me so much to hear Jesus talk about his betrayers. Jesus talk about the ones who left him when it mattered most, the ones who fled, who were nowhere around. They had spent 3 years with the man. They said things that they didn't mean, and they made promises that they didn't keep. But the day he was raised from the dead, he said, go get me some brothers. Awe is found. The truth is found in wonder and in forgiveness. You see, because God's Word wakes us up to our need. In Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 8, we're told, it's by grace that we've been saved. Not of ourselves, it's nothing that we have done. We have been saved. And all that we are left to do is stand in awe of the truth that is redemption. You want to follow your calling? You want to be inspired to do what it is that God has called you to do. Stand in awe of complete and total redemption. You see, while we are trying to save ourselves, we never experience. While we are trying to accomplish and achieve salvation on our own, we miss out on the mystery of redemption and the loving dependence on God. And the radical demands of the gospel, they remind us of that dependence daily. When we regain our wonder, when we regain that awe, church, we will regain the truth. And we will live the truth in such a way that it will be unmistakable to a community that is thirsting, starving for the truth. In an election time when all we want is someone that we can trust, someone that we can feel good about, our country is starving for the truth. The question is, can we be in such awe of God that we provide that for them? As together we stand and as we stand.